Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine broadcasting on WOC Low Power 105.3 FM Troy and WOS Low Power 98.9 FM Schenectady from the Sanctuary of Independent Media in Troy, New York. I am Justin Lee Romero.
And I'm Kalen. Tonight, Mark Dunley speaks with Lee Daly about his new article for New York News.
Then, Kalen talks with two students at the College of St. Rose about courses cuts made by the college.
Later on, Sina Basili Hickey talks with Wayne Ho about anti-Asian violence.
And after that, Steve Pierce talks with Steve Burns about ghost kitchens.
And finally, Anika Strelo talks with Cameron McKinley and Jimmy Balmer about the Boys and Girls Club on our community. And now, some headlines.
Governor Cuomo is coming under increasing political attacks over his mishandling of nursing homes and allegations of sexual harassment. A second former aide to Cuomo has accused him of sexual harassment, saying that he has asked her questions about her sex life, whether she was monogamous in her relationships, and if she had ever had sex with older men. Cuomo tried to explain away his statements as jokes, and Cuomo's attempt to have a role in selecting someone to investigate the allegations was shot down by everyone. Tish James, the state attorney general, will select an independent investigator. In face of ongoing Republican opposition, the Democrats have abandoned their efforts to raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour in the COVID relief package, with the House pass as to the Senate. And the Times Union reports that over 200 eviction proceedings were scheduled Friday in Albany City Court, making the end of the 60-day stay on all evictions in New York. There were no eviction hearings scheduled in the Troy and Saratoga Springs. Schenectady and six eviction hearings scheduled. Tenants can hold off any evictions until May 1st if they're related to hardships from COVID. Many tenants have been unable to obtain government relief related to COVID to help with the rent. Matters concerning holdover tenants who were in the process of eviction when the pandemic kicked in and other issues not related to the health crisis are now expected to proceed.
The Gazette reports that 2 years after the proposal was submitted, state officials have signed off on Schenectady City School District's request to spend $2 million under the Smart School Bond Act to upgrade the district's computer network infrastructure.
The Record reports that strong buyers' demand continues among the Capital Region real estate market. Compared to about a year ago, average prices on existing homes increased 12% to $236,000. In Rensselaer County, the median sales price on existing homes increased to $201,000, while in Albany County, it was $236,000.
The latest positive test rate for COVID-19 in New York State was 3.58%. 80 people lost their lives to the virus on Sunday, and 5,300 individuals remain hospitalized statewide.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and this is your local news produced by the community, for the community, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
This program is kept on air by many volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. Thank you very much. To hear all the stories on today's program, visit mediasanctuary.org. To send comments, suggestions, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or call 518-272-2390. You can also find us on Instagram and Facebook at Media Sanctuary.
Lou Daly is the author of the new report from the New York News, False Solutions, Gas and Trash: How the Fossil Fuel Industry is Holding Back a Just Transition. Daly, the former research director at Demos, discussing bioenergy, renewable natural gas, and green hydrogen. By Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We're joined by Lou Daly, a climate advisor in New York State and former research director of Demos. And on behalf of New York News, he recently wrote a report, False Solutions, Gas and Trash, How the Fossil Fuel Industry is Holding Back a Just Transition. Now, Lou, we've had people on a number of times from New York News. There's a broad-based climate coalition, a lot of EJ community groups. But, you know, why did you decide, or why did New York News decide to put out this report?
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be here. Basically, because in the wake of the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, which really was the platform of New York Renews in many ways, and that was passed in 2019, what we've begun to see is the activation, essentially, of fossil fuel interests looking for ways to retain their hold on New York State's energy system, even as the state has now codified a pathway to zero carbon electricity by 2040 and net zero total emissions economy-wide by 2050. And we call this this new force within New York State, the sort of the bioenergy industrial complex, and it's interrelated with the fossil fuel energy, you know, energy industries in many ways. And so what we've been concerned about is that the incumbent fossil fuel system is looking for ways to retain its grip on New York's energy system through a set of false solutions that are broadly defined as bioenergy.
Now, the CLCPA, the climate bill you talked about, a law, you know, did create this Climate Action Council, which has, I guess, until 2013 to develop a plan for climate action in New York State. I know some in the New York Renews, you know, members serve on both the council and some of its advisory committees. So what are some of your biggest concerns with bioenergy? You know, why aren't these good solutions for the climate?
I think for three fundamental reasons. The first that I would emphasize, and this really goes to kind of the corporate interests, the fossil interests, in many cases, such as biomethane, which is renewable, described as renewable natural gas derived from waste streams like landfill, livestock manure, also hydrogen. What you're seeing is a big push by the gas utilities to almost redefine these derivatives of carbon energy as renewable forms of gas in order to lock in the gas infrastructure and delivery system and to perpetuate natural gas's hold in New York by way of blending these cleaner forms of gas with the fossil gas. And so they're very transparent about it. National Grid has said it is a major priority of theirs to introduce these fuel blends with biomethane and hydrogen as a way of greening the existing gas system. And for us, that means what that tells us, it's a way of locking in their infrastructure and retaining their hold, or the hold of natural gas in our energy grid, which, as you know, is a very large fraction of our energy.
Now, one of the things I know, for instance, I've had some discussions with Food and Water Watch about has been anaerobic digesters, which, among other things, can be used to recover methane emissions from landfill. But they then point out, yeah, but the industry is really looking to develop factory farms and huge production of manure, and this is a way to subsidize it. Do you particularly address the issue of anaerobic digesters, and is there a short-term role for them?
Yes, I think we do. We support them in a limited role, capturing the methane that would otherwise go into the atmosphere for local uses on site seems fine to us. In fact, on a net basis, positive. The problem is of course, as you mentioned, the scale of it, and whether or not you're taking that methane and putting it into the gas delivery system, where it will leak like other forms of methane into the atmosphere. Of course, a very powerful greenhouse gas, more so than carbon dioxide, but also will be combusted at the for end uses and emit nitrogen dioxide and other co-pollutants into our communities.
Now, biomass is one of the ones you also label as a false solution. I believe over in Vermont, which has, you know, reputation of being fairly green, They actually get, I believe, more than 20% of their electricity from burning wood and, you know, wood scale utilities. What are some of the particular problems with biomass?
Biomass, is, in some ways, all bioenergy is produced from biomass. But yes, specifically, we're talking about biomass energy where you are directly combusting organic material. And that primarily means wood. Well, I mean, the pollution from, you know, certainly in more densely populated areas from burning wood is more dangerous than burning fossil fuels. And the big concern, one thing your listeners should know is, for example, in Europe, the largest source of what is classified as renewable energy now is wood pellets. Wood pellets has been the main replacement fuel for coal in Europe, and that is driving deforestation in the south, the creation of a whole industry around wood energy that is highly carbon intensive and is justified as carbon neutral because of the theory that the carbon locked into the trees automatically neutralizes the intense carbon emissions that you release when you burn the wood. And that's just not true, because when you burn the wood, that's essentially a carbon bomb going into the atmosphere immediately. And then it takes 30 years or more to regrow to the full growth of the forest to neutralize those emissions. And of course, on a timeline like that, 30 years to get to carbon neutral from burning wood, it's too late.
One of the other things you put in here is green hydrogen. You know, some people view hydrogen as a cleaner fuel. You know, what are the problems with green hydrogen?
Great question and very important question. There's a huge, huge industry push now, roadmap to a hydrogen economy. You may have seen the McKinsey report that came out last October, fossil fuel interests behind it. There are two problems. One is that currently hydrogen production, 95% of which is produced using fossil heat to derive hydrogen gas from methane. So it's carbon intensive, and on a net basis, even though it's used in industrial processes as a replacement for fossil heat, especially in fertilizer, cement, and steel, the carbon intensity of how you actually produce the hydrogen, because you have to apply fossil heat, on a net basis, it's pretty much a wash, or it's more carbon intensive. So deriving hydrogen from fossil fuels is obviously not a solution to the climate crisis. Now, what's called green hydrogen is where you use renewable electricity for electrolysis of water to break off the hydrogen molecules and gasify the water to create hydrogen gas. The problem with this, I would propose, and there's no clear consensus on this, but is that you have to create hydrogen, green hydrogen on any scale, you have to draw away renewable electricity from the grid and from the transportation sector for electrification of cars, from the building sector for electrification of buildings and heat, in ways that I think will destabilize the grid and slow down the renewable energy transition we need in those other sectors, renewable electricity that we need in other sectors much more urgently.
Let me just jump in here to say we've been talking with Lou Dealey, author of Fall Solution, Gas and Trash. You can check out the publication at newyorkrenews.org. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
That was Mark Dunley, who spoke with Lee Daly. Find out more about Lou Daly's report. Go to our website, mediasanctuary.org.
The College of St. Rose cut about 70% of all the programs offered by the college, which serves the local community and the students. Kaylin, my co-host tonight, caught up with two of the students from St. Rose, Lydia Finn and Sarah Parisi.
This is Kaylin. I am reporting for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine today. I am talking with Lydia Flynn and Sarah Parisi. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself and what is going on with the College of St. Rose in the music department?
You can go first, Sarah, if you'd like.
Sure. So again, my name is Sarah. I'm 20 years old. I am a junior music education major at the College of St. Rose. And long story short, St. Rose is just not making decisions that really consider the student body as a whole and making a lot of cuts to the programs that they offer and affecting a lot of students in the process.
Any thoughts on this, Lydia?
Hi, I'm Lydia Flynn. I am sort of a junior. We'll be graduating after next semester. So I'm a music BA major. My major is being cut as well. I'm also a psych minor. And yeah, our majors are being cut without anyone really adhering to the student body as a whole. And just, yeah, it's been difficult for them to get to listen to us and actually, you know.
Is it the whole music department getting cut or is it just certain programs?
It's certain programs. It's like about 75%. So there's four music majors. There's BA, I'm music BA. Sarah is dead. Yeah. And then performance is also getting cut. And music industry. Music industry is the only surviving
music program.
Music program, yeah. And sure, it's great that's surviving, but everything else is getting cut. And the music, specifically the music ed degree, is one of the like first majors to be implemented by the college. It's about like 100 years old, and they're cutting that. And it completely violates, I mean, you can check the mission statement on the St. Rose website. It's violating what the mission statement states about, you know, offering the liberal arts education and supporting the education of educators, future aspiring educators. And even with the music industry kids, they're going to be losing, you know, because everything else is getting cut, like including general music classes like music history, music theory, I'm going to say, except like contemporary harmony, because that's what the music industry kids get. But big classes like those are going to be removed, and that's still going to impact their overall liberal ed, like education that was promised by the school, but kind of isn't at this point.
Yeah. So all of the majors in the music department work together very closely. We share a lot of faculty. We share a lot of resources, all of that. So cutting these majors not only harms, you know, the majors who are being cut, but it also does affect music industry. Because, like, yes, the college said that they will make accommodations so that we can still get our degree and our classes, but it's not going to be taught by the professors that, you know, we all know and love and trust. So
exactly. And even so, like, they're just, I mean, even what Sarah was saying, like, we're such a close-knit group, and it's almost like we're kind of like at each other, and not like, you know, like we're in a really difficult position where we're kind of like split up, if that makes any sense. And there's been like, it's been not so great to like our family as a whole, and it's been, you know, detrimental to like the connections that we've made. And it's even more painful to see, at least from my standpoint, to see my professors that I've known for almost 3 years now lose their jobs that they've worked so hard for, some of them being here like way long before than I was. Started working like the late 90s, like 96. I heard one of them worked there, and they're getting cut and they're fully tenured. And I'm close with a lot of them, and they've done so much for not just me, but everybody and people before me. And yeah, not to mention there's so many music educators who come, not just educators, but performers who come out of the St. Rose like music program, and it's going to be cut. And then, you know, where are the educators going to come from? Because everyone rely, the community, it's going to impact the community is what I'm trying to say. Like, just every, there's so many people who rely on this program when it comes to like getting their music ed degrees. And like, where are we going to get our educators from to teach young kids music and inspire them? And more than just that, like, I'm not the educating person like Sarah is here, but I'm sure she can agree with me, right?
100%.
Yeah.
Just to budge in here.
Yeah, sorry.
The interview running. Why do you think the school cut the program, the music department programs? Or do you guys not know? Or
the college said that they cut it due to financial strain on the college. The college has been in debt since 2013, almost filed bankruptcy, I want to say in 2017, but I could be slightly wrong about that. It could be 2016. It's in that area. And they said that the only way to save the school would be to cut all of these programs so that they could continue having a college at all. However, they could have made so many different decisions and different cuts and different ways to save the same money that wouldn't have involved cutting such foundational programs at the college. And we've tried to tell them this and they just won't listen to us. They won't even hear us out.
Right. And I've even heard some other like college, like people who work with the college in different departments say that like, oh, like your program is small. It doesn't mean anything. No, we have like one of the largest programs, like as a whole. There's so many like music students that exist on campus. And I've even heard from a friend recently, like it's hard to like not even spot a music major. Like they're everywhere. We're a very big group. And yeah, we don't definitively know, like, I mean, yeah, with the financial stuff, but there's still a lot unsaid that we don't know about. And we want those answers and they won't give them to us at all.
That's crazy. If I was a student, I'd want those answers. An optimistic world, do you think they would bring back the programs maybe in the far down the road future?
I would like to think so. I mean, even now we're fighting so hard to get it back because it obviously means the world to us. I mean, it's quite hard to see that future because it's such a bleak reality that we're living in, that we're going to be losing our so many people and teachers that are so close to us. Yeah, I mean, I hope that we can still keep, I hope that we can still fight for it and have it back and maybe, and, you know, or at least, like you said, down the road for it to come back, Sarah.
I think that they don't really see how big of an impact this is going to have on the school, because as Lydia said, like the music department makes up such a large part of the community. Like not only are we students, but almost like half of the RAs on campus are music majors. Like it's going to make a very large impact, and I don't think they're thinking about that. So I think after a couple years they're really going to realize how much it's affecting the school in a negative way, and they might try to reverse it. But I sincerely think that with these cuts that St. Rose is making and the fact that they're not thinking about the outcomes of these decisions, St. Rose is going to crumble and fall within the next 5 years. So there won't be a school to bring these majors back to.
Yeah. And to add, like, again, they're kind of violating the mission statement by cutting music out of a liberal arts school. And there are so many music majors that exist. And, you know, it may not bring as much money as other departments, but it's still a really big department that does bring in some cash. So I see it crumbling and falling too, to be frankly honest.
So to get this correct, the College of St. Rose is a predominantly music-based college.
Well, it's liberal arts. So
liberal arts, yes.
Yeah, so, yeah, they are. It is a liberal arts school. However, they are cutting every single art program that is offered at the college and yeah, all but one music program. So all that is going to be left are the majors that you can get at any school across the country.
That's crazy.
Everything that makes St. Rose unique is going to be gone, except for music industry. And I understand that music industry is their biggest program of music, and it brings in a lot of people and a lot of publicity. Julia Gargano graduated from the music industry program, and she went on to be on American Idol and brought in a lot of attention to the school. And I recognize that. However, part of the appeal of St. Rose is the broad array of majors that we have in each of these programs, and that's going to be gone. So right, while the school doesn't revolve around music as a whole, these arts programs do make up a very large portion of campus.
Will you guys continue at the college, or will you change what you're studying or go to another college?
I very heavily considered transferring. I almost did. I wasn't even sure that I was going to stay until this past month. And the only reason that I am staying and not transferring is because all of my credits will not transfer, and I will end up having to take an extra year of school, if not more, requiring me losing even more money. So it just in the long run wasn't worth it. I decided to overload credits instead to get out a little early if possible. However, yeah, I almost transferred, and I know a lot of people who are and or are switching their majors. So
as do I. There are a lot of younger people. I don't think we mentioned this either, but Sarah and I are technically like the least impacted out of all of the juniors and seniors are like the least impacted when it comes to like finishing our degree. But when it comes to the sophomores and juniors, yeah, sophomores and freshmen have a bit of a harder time. Like yeah, we graduate, but it may not be a possibility for them? Is that right? Okay.
Their programs, their degree is going to be drastically affected by these cuts, to the point where our own faculty has literally told us that we will not be getting the education that we are paying for and even recommended that they transfer. I even know music industry students who are transferring because they recognize how much these cuts are going to affect the music department as a whole, not just the ones that are being cut. So yeah, it's not ideal.
No, it's not.
Where can our listeners find info or help with the cause? Or
there is a petition going around. It's in my Instagram bio. If anyone wants to sign and, you know, help us, it's my Instagram at is Lydia is a nerd, LYDIA, all one word, lowercase. And yeah, you'll be able to find it in the bio and everything. There's a priceless, not worthless t-shirt being sold on Facebook. I don't really know what the link is to that. Do you know where it is, Sarah?
I do not know. I'm sure if you went onto Facebook and entered the hashtag Soul of St. Rose or anything along those lines, everything you would need to find would pop up.
Yeah, and there's even like a TikTok account on TikTok, and it's called Soul of St. Rose, and it's been sharing out the different TikToks that students have made. I think mine are on there too.
Is there anything that I didn't ask you specifically that you'd like to add to this interview?
Help us increase your voices. That's all I have to do. I want to really stress that. Please hear our voices. Please try and help us the best you can and sign the petition, because we need your support desperately. And Sarah?
I would also just like to point out that the Board of Trustees who made these decisions does not have a single musician or music advocate on their team. There was not a single person to stand up for the music or the arts on that team. And just like every other place you hear of across the world, or at least the United States, but I'm sure across the world, when cuts have to be made, the music and arts are the first to go. And it's not fair. And it really just shows that people don't value our art and they don't value us, even though we are an integral part to the world.
And actually I forgot the name of the college, but there was a college that was going through some financial deficits due to, the coronavirus and everything, but they were able to save their music department. They spared it because they knew how important it was. So, I mean, I could probably find the article to you and share it with you, Kaylin, but it's possible to save arts and to consider that. It is possible, and it's still super important.
Yes, I would agree. The arts are important. This has been Kaylin McPherson reporting for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Today, I was talking with two students of the College of St. Rose, Lydia Flynn and Sarah Parisi. All the links that they talked about will be on our website. I'd like to thank you for joining me today. Very nice interview.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome.
If you wish to help bring back the programs to the College of St. Rose, sign the chance petition that is linked on our website. And to find out other ways to help keep the music programs going, at our website at mediasanctuary.org.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Justin.
And I'm Kaylin. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOC 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA 107.3 FM Albany.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through our email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
Wayne Ho, President and CEO of Chinese American Planning Council, Inc., spoke with HMM Sina Basila Hickey about the recent surge in anti-Asian violence. In part one of this interview, Ho talked about why there is currently an increase in anti-Asian violence and some of the history of Asian American civil rights movement. In this segment, Ho continues the conversation and starts off by addressing the needs for restorative justice.
Thank you, Wayne Ho, for speaking with me. What role should law enforcement have in stopping hate crimes?
So we understand that when there's community members who go to the subway station every day and they see someone who happens to be yelling at them or, God forbid, have been a perpetrator of violence against them, or if we have individuals that have to go to work and take the same path to work every day, and they're seeing a person who had spat at them or pushed them or called them names, or people who come to your business and are continuing to do the same thing day after day. We understand that these actions have to stop. I think we also want to be clear that while we need safety for the Asian American community, that we don't want to perpetuate a structurally racist criminal justice system. What we need right now is not incarcerating more people who might be harassing and being violent towards Asian Americans, but we need to make sure that we have transformative justice. We have restorative justice. So while we appreciate that the NYPD, for example, has started a task force on Asian hate crimes, there's a mayor's office to stop hate crimes, and the Human Rights Commission and DA's offices have been working together with a lot of Asian American nonprofits around the issue. The response is not just Asian Americans getting together with decision makers and law enforcement. The proper response is Asian Americans, other communities of color should get together with law enforcement and government leaders to figure out how we can promote restorative justice. So the role of law enforcement is not necessarily locking up more people. In restorative justice, law enforcement needs to bring together both parties, the perpetrator and the victim, needs to educate both parties of their rights, needs to make sure that those parties have an opportunity for reconciliation. And that should be the role of the NYPD. That's in the short term. In the long term, we need to make sure that there's more investment in mental health services, there's more investment in communities, there's more investment in living wage jobs and housing and healthcare and social services for all our community members, because everyone should be safe and have dignified experiences on the streets.
Yes, yes. That brings me to this question of being a victim of a racist incident, whether it's verbal or physical, can be traumatizing. And what kind of support should be offered to our community for victims of racism?
We need to make sure that victims of racism and harassment really understand their rights. It's very jarring when things like that happen. For example, I have workers, because we provide essential human services, who during the pandemic were on subways going to provide services, and people would yell at them, throw things at them, spat at them. That happened to many of my staff and to many of our community members. I myself was walking in Brooklyn one day during the shutdown, and a man, another person of color, came up to me and elbowed me up against Barclays Center, against the wall, and just started yelling at me and saying racial epithets. And it's just very shocking to have that happen, and you don't really know how to respond. But what I think we need to do is make sure that we continue to work together. And that's where, before the shutdown happened, and now we're trying to do it virtually, is make sure there's education of their rights, understanding how they can report these acts, understanding the proper role that law enforcement and the district attorney's office can play. Also, we have to do more bystander training. We need to make sure that any of us who happen to see these acts of violence and harassment, that we know how to intervene in a safe way and not exacerbate the situation, but de-escalate the situation. So I think, and I've seen other allies of ours also provide trainings on self-defense. I would say that's something not just for Asian Americans, but we know women, we know children, we know a lot of vulnerable populations should learn better self-defense, unfortunately, in order to protect themselves. And I want to be clear that that's for defensive purposes. It's not to become offensive or proactively attack somebody too. So I think these are some steps that we can take right now to make sure that people have more agency around their own safety.
Well, I'm sorry that that happened to you. I think a larger training needs to be done for bystander training, but is there some advice that you could give for individuals who either want to support their neighbors, or if they see something happen, like how to intervene?
I think there's other experts in bystander trainings and others, but I think the first step is being able to quickly identify what's happening. If you can safely intervene and de-escalate verbally, please try to do so. If you see that the situation is escalating, then whatever you can do to remove the victim from the situation and try to escort them away from the situation and not get into verbal altercations and not get into physical altercations with whoever the perpetrator is. I think we have to make a personal decision on whether or not to call 911 or to record on our cell phones the incident. But I think the main situation is that, unfortunately, right now, it's our responsibility as community members, as New Yorkers, that we need to try and keep each other safe. And whatever we could do to step in between, to de-escalate a situation, take somebody out of it, and make sure that they themselves are safe, and then figure out how authorities can get involved is probably the best next step.
I mean, the community reaction needs to go deeper. What about schools? Where should we be building these support systems to have these dialogues, to really work through understanding our neighbors, who makes up our community? And maybe more than schools, maybe you have a different suggestion, but what are some of your thoughts?
I think schools are a good starting point. I have two children who are both in elementary school. And I think one of the most powerful things I've seen recently is that they're learning about Black Lives Matter, and there's better curriculum around other communities of color, and learning also about respect for all, which is something that all New York City public schools should be doing, to learn better about respecting other students, regardless of their identity, race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, and other identities. And I think that's a starting point, is that we want to make sure that our children know how to be respectful towards each other, be kind towards each other. I think moving beyond schools, that we need to make sure that our city, which is a very segregated city, that there's opportunities for communities to learn from each other. And I think it's really up to elected officials, community leaders, nonprofit organizations, the community board, to make sure that there are opportunities for communities to get together, to learn about each other, that there's positive news stories and positive coverage happening. And I think we did see that during the pandemic. I know a lot of times the news reported on negative things that happened in our community, but the reality is there's a lot of positive things that happened. We saw people donating to restaurant workers and to others that lost their jobs. We saw mutual aid groups popping up and collecting food, collecting books, collecting laptops, and giving out to those who didn't have it. We saw people delivering food to NYCHA, to homebound seniors, to the disabled. And I think that spirit of charity, that spirit of change, and that spirit of justice is what we need at this time. And that's where, as hard as the pandemic has been for our community, I see it not just as a glass half full. I don't see it as a glass half empty. I actually see it as a glass half full, that New Yorkers did pull together and try their best to support everyone during a really, really hard time.
And to our listeners who might be thinking, well, I'm based in Albany, I'm not in New York City, how is this relevant? I mean, of course, I think the reporting is certainly just underreported up here, but what would you say to our listeners who think that they don't relate to this issue?
For your listeners, I would say two things. I think first is that Asian Americans are the fastest growing population in the entire country, and the fastest growing population in New York. In every city, every county of New York, Asian Americans are the fastest growing group. So I would just encourage your listeners to make sure that their first reaction is not exactly picking up the phone and calling 911, but making sure that whether it's an Asian American or a woman who's getting harassed, or a senior that might be experiencing elder abuse, that we as bystanders are intervening on any types of harassment and violence, but doing so in a very safe way, protecting ourselves and protecting the victims. But I think secondly, especially for listeners who live in Albany, is that that is the state capital. And our government, our governor, the state legislature should be doing more at this time to support our communities. And that does not mean investing in more policing or over-policing. It means investing in more social services and human services and healthcare supports. Whenever there is a deficit that the city is facing or the state is facing, the first thing that elected officials do is cut social services. And that's what we need right now, is not balancing the budget on the backs of the most vulnerable. We need to make sure that we're investing in the most vulnerable during that time.
Thank you, Wayne Ho, for speaking with me. Is there anything that I missed that you feel like needs to be included in this conversation?
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. I think that for those of us who work in the Asian American community, we've seen a lot of these issues over the decades, from the anti-Asian violence and hate crimes to a lack of resources in our community to being treated like the perpetual foreigner. So I think that the fact that there's more news stories, so thank you again for covering this, about what's happening in the Asian American community because of the pandemic is an opportunity for people to learn and be more educated, not only about the Asian American community, but also what are some solutions that our communities and other communities of color need at this time. So I appreciate the opportunity to shed a light on these issues.
That was Wayne Ho, president of CEO of Chinese American Planning Council, Inc., speaking with HMN's Sina Basila-Hickey about the recent surge in anti-Asian violence. Hear the full segment on our website.
Coming on our next segment, HMM correspondent Steve Pierce spoke with Albany Times Union food writer Steve Barnes about his new phenomenon of ghost kitchens in this third part of their interview.
I'm Steve Barnes. I am a senior writer, restaurant columnist, and theater critic for the Times Union.
Steve, you recently wrote in the Times Union about the rise of a new restaurant phenomenon, ghost restaurants. What is a ghost restaurant?
Okay, a ghost restaurant is basically, it's delivery only. In rare cases, you can pick up from there, but it's usually delivery only. So you don't know where the physical location is. And when this first started, it was in big cities, and an operator might have five separate menus. And they all came out of the same kitchen, crew cooking five separate menus for five separate niche audiences. And, you know, in a dense place like, you know, New York, Chicago, Boston, you know, that made sense. And in fact, in Albany now, there is one of them called the Cloud Food Hall. And it happens to be in downtown Albany. They do pickup. But, you know, at this point, I think they're up to like seven concepts, from, you know, soul food to Korean and barbecue and healthy salads and burgers. And it all comes out of the same kitchen. So it's, if our conception of a restaurant was, you know, well, what kind of restaurant is it? You know, it's a steakhouse. It's a sushi restaurant. It's New American. It's vegetarian. Now, and it's in one location, that's where you go for that. Now there's no actual location. It comes to you. So it's sort of, you know, like the equivalent of an online retailer like Amazon, where you can get anything. And in its ideal form, it's great for the consumer because they have lots of options. It's good for the business owner because they can go after different markets without having to have multiple locations, because real estate is expensive. They also don't have to worry about servers or front of house or making it look pretty. They need a kitchen and easy access for drivers and a good front door that people can go in and out of all day while they're doing deliveries. However, it's gotten a bit corrupted in my view. And this is I have no objection in concept to ghost kitchens, because, as I mentioned, the Cloud Food Hall in Albany is an independent guy who started in Troy with sort of a food hall, food court, you know, a bunch of independent operators around a central large space. And he went to strictly takeout and delivery with his next concept. That's an independent operator who had this idea. He's making it work, and it's the future because it's ordering through the app. You know, I like that. I've read stories of like a pizza place in New York City that had extra dough, started making bread out of their pizza dough, and they developed a sandwich brand. But instead of having people have to navigate through the pizza menu to find their sandwiches, where they're relegated at the bottom and nobody buys them, they created a whole separate brand. So instead of Dom's Pizza, it would be Dom's Sandwiches. And you thought of it as a separate restaurant, it's a separate menu, and it was all sorts of different funky, creative sandwiches. And this was another source of revenue that they could market in a different way for a different audience, probably than pizza. And that works for them. That's great. But the way ghost kitchens have been co-opted, at least to my mind, is the way they've been taken over by celebrities. There's companies out there that approach celebrities, say, we've got the infrastructure to do this, lend your name to it, give us a type of food you like, and then we'll take existing restaurants, usually chains that are slower now because of the pandemic, and we'll put you in there. And what this makes possible is there's this kid who's a YouTube star. He's 22 years old. He had nothing to do with food whatsoever. And he does stunts. Like, he does a speeded up video of him counting to 100,000. And he does other crazy things. And sometimes he just gives away money. Sponsors give him money. And he walks into a charity and hands them 50 grand. And this developed him 50 million followers to the Mr. Beast YouTube channel. Well, he partnered with one of the big ghost kitchen companies, and in one day, on one single day in December, launched 300 Mr. Beast burgers locations nationwide, and they all went into mass chain restaurants, and in the capital region, it happens to be the Buca di Beppo restaurant on Wolf Road, because Buca di Beppo is giant portions, and it's usually big parties going out for Italian. Well, a lot of that wasn't happening. And so Buca di Beppo had a big available kitchen, and they had kitchen staff. So their corporate parents have made the agreement all over the country to do things like these ghost kitchen driven by celebrity. Now, you know, people dream for years and years and years of opening their own restaurant, and they scrimp and save and do it all themselves. And here's a 22-year-old kid with no experience launching, you know, a burger concept 300 communities nationwide on the same day. That just offends me. Similarly, what just happened in the capital region is Guy Fieri, who at least in his defense has been a chef and restaurant owner for 25 years, but is now mostly known as a star on Food Network. Guy Fieri launched more than 100 locations of his Flavor Town. Flavor Town is one of Guy's catchphrases. You know, like Emeril was always bam. Well, Flavortown is Guy Fieri's, you know, bold, explosive flavor. And he does, you know, Flavortown Kitchen, which has a total of like a chicken sandwich, a burger, a couple of salads, some really sort of sloppy, messy apps. There's maybe 15 things total on the menu. And he started at 100 restaurants nationwide. And again, he's going into Buca di Beppo. So it's all driven by celebrity. This kid, Mr. Beast, has 50 million followers who are going to try some of his food because they like his brand. You know, Guy Fieri's fans are going to say, hey, we know Guy Fieri. Well, let's go to Flavortown. Let's order it. And that, to my mind, that is taking away money from people like Corey Nelson, who opened Cloud Food Hall in Troy Kitchen. It's also taking away from independent restaurants like, say, Cafe Capriccio in Albany that is doing lots of takeout. It's taking money away from Crave Burgers in Albany, which does outstanding burgers and delivery. And, you know, why somebody would order from Guy Fieri or Mr. Beast instead of Crave, where I can tell you who the chef is, where he gets his product, and how much he cares. I can't tell you a thing about Mr. Beast or Guy Fieri other than what's on their websites.
So what you're describing sounds like just an acceleration of everything everywhere, where you have venture capital defining a concept and then mobilizing their financial resources to rent unused kitchen space in various markets. And you know, it doesn't really have anything to do with food. It could be anything.
Right. If they could figure out a way to make cars cheaply out of unused car plants, they would do that. But food is cheap, because all you have to do, once you've got this in place, you're going to have central production kitchens that are making, you know, Guy Fieri's jalapeno poppers, which are stuffed with andouille sausage and pimento cream cheese and wrapped in bacon. So they're making these by the millions, freezing them, and then FedEx trucks come and take them to the 100 locations of Flavortown. The infrastructure is in place to get food fast all over the country. It's there, something they can do, and then they explode it off of celebrity. And so, you know, one of the other ones is Paulie G, who was on that lamentable Jersey Shore TV show. He has a subs concept that's running out of chain restaurants. Mariah Carey has a cookies concept. All it is Mariah Carey's name. She probably sat in an office, you know, tasting five cookies and said, I like those. Maybe less, you know, pecans. And And then Mario Lopez does Mexican. And it's all Ghost Kitchen. It's all driven by celebrity. And it's all driven, to my mind, by corporate cynicism and an opportunity to make a buck off the backs of the little guys. They think by 2030, this could be, Ghost Kitchens could be twice the annual revenue of full service restaurants.
That was HMM correspondent Steve Pierce speaking with Steve Barnes of the Albany Times Union about the new phenomenon of ghost kitchens. This is a third part of this three-part interview, and you can catch the rest of it on our website at mediasanctuary.org.
Next, we have a segment from the ACT series, which was created by students of the Spring 21 Art Community Technology class at RPI. Today, we will be hearing from Cameron McKinley, the Director of Operations, and her teammate Jimmy Bulmer at the Boys and Girls Club of the Capital Region. Annika Sterlo will be interviewing them to learn more about how the Boys and Girls Club impact their youth of our community.
Hello, everyone. I'm Annika Strelo from Art Community and Technology. And with me today, I have Cameron and Jimmy from the Boys and Girls Clubs of the Capital Area. So I'm wondering if the two of you can tell me a little bit about your organization's main message and how that impacts the community.
The Boys and Girls Clubs of the Capital Area officially formed in 2019. It was a joining of forces between the Troy Boys and Girls Club and Boys and Girls Clubs of Albany in a mission to help provide more strategic support and expand our reach beyond the two clubhouses and cities that we were operating with to support our kids. The Boys and Girls Club, our mission is to inspire and enable all young people, especially those who need us most, to realize their full potential as productive, caring, and responsible citizens. How we do that is we have fun with a purpose. We provide loving, caring adults with some proven model best practice programming to really help meet the needs of our kids and support them on their track towards a great future. We typically serve anywhere from 1,800 to 1,900 youth at 20 different locations, whether that be ranging from pre-K students all the way up until teens and young adulthood.
Having fun with a purpose. I love that. And so you talked about the merger a little bit. What were some of the biggest challenges you faced while trying to do that?
I would say, you know, staffing was a huge, huge issue because we're combining everybody, you know, that either works separately and not together. Now we're mixed. We mixed everybody together and everybody seemed to get together and work well together. I feel like the community and the people that work with the Boys and Girls Club are just fantastic and easy to get along with for the most part. And I think just our overall, you know, workload, I think since we joined it, there was so much more to do. So we expanded, you know, probably doubled the size of our running facility and our staffing that first year. So that was the hardest thing for me to keep up with, just how fast we are growing.
And in addition to that, thank you, Cameron. And definitely agree with what you said there. And in addition, we were really just blending two different cultures, two different cities, and trying to make sure that as we form this new branding, this new way in which we're trying to serve more students, that we don't lose what was important to our communities and the Boys and Girls Clubs that had remained there for over 50 years. So really trying to move forward, create a new identity and blend cultures and environments while remaining intact to our roots, I think was something that was challenging, but it was also very beneficial for us because it forced us to dive into the strengths and weaknesses of the different team members, programs that we're blending together to really make a stronger model that we have today.
Yeah, for sure. That makes sense. And then on the topic of challenges, since the COVID-19 pandemic, how has your organization been impacted?
We've been impacted at first. It was fear. It was how can we continue to do what we love? And then it was inspiration and motivation. So understanding what was going on in the community, what other nonprofits, school districts, just community supporters were doing, so we weren't duplicating efforts, and holistically trying to make sure that we ease the burden that was already placed, or was already placed on our families, and even more so now. Really, that was one of the biggest things for me.
Yeah, no, that definitely makes sense. Trying to keep things as normal as possible in this crazy world. Have you had any unique opportunities due to the pandemic? So like anything positive that's come out of it?
I mean, I think our food service is one of the most positive things, being able to deliver that many meals to families, to kids that may not have had that prior to.
And in addition, one trend that we saw not only with our organization, but others, was that during a crisis and during a pandemic, you really see what makes our community great is that people want to help, they want to step up, they want to support, and we were able to make it through for many donations, volunteers that came and served meals with us every day, starting in March. Cameron, myself, our CEO, everybody along the team, we were all working in the food program alongside, and really alongside great volunteers that helped get us through, and community members that continue to support us as we move forward.
Wow, that's really amazing that people are that generous. And then just lastly, is there anything else you want to tell our listeners about your organization, about a typical day at the Boys and Girls Club?
Yes, I did see one other question I would like to touch on before that, if it's okay, just our food program and kind of what we did. So before, we were serving meals. Every club member received dinner within our programs, and we were bringing it off to many different places. But when everything shut down, we changed our model to a mobile meal delivery service. So we partnered with different housing authorities and school districts to help meet students and families where they're at. And we provide and produce everything in our commercial kitchen in Troy, and then load them up in vans. And it went out to the cities of Albany, Rensselaer, and Troy. And we were at, I think, I want to say roughly 15 different locations, and putting out 13,000 meals a week in the thick of the pandemic and when it really ramped up. And over the course of the year, we were able to serve 450,000 meals, and they're all free for those who receive them.
Wow, that's quite an accomplishment. People must have been extremely grateful.
And it was fun, and we just got to see our kids. I grew up in Lansingburg, and when I was able to go to Corliss Park, one of the areas that we were serving, and where I grew up kind of hanging out, it was just really awesome and motivational, and just continued to inspire me to do this work and remain in this field. And we have a motto, we say we do whatever it takes for our kids to succeed. And I really felt that personally, and I think we showed it.
And on the topic of volunteering, actually, how can any of our listeners reach out to get involved working with you or the kids?
Any volunteer that's interested in learning more about our opportunities, we do have a volunteer coordination lead. They can visit our website at egccapitalarea.org or reach out to Lorenzo Sibilia. He is currently involved with helping get people set up with volunteer opportunities. At the end of the day, if you want, you can just pick up the phone, give us a call, 518-462-5528. Ask around and we'll help get you connected.
We just heard an interview from Anika Strelo with Carmen and McKinley and her teammate Jimmy Bomer on their programs developed at the Boys and Girls Club of the Capital Area. And that concludes our show, ladies and folks. We've hoped you'd enjoy this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Justin.
And I'm Kalen. Our engineer is the amazing Sina Basila Hickey. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comment suggestions or to comment on our work, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio efforts, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on media nights on Monday nights at 7:07 by sending an email requesting an invitation link at hmmmediasanctuary.org. Until next time, guys, thanks for tuning in.